What's up, guys? So listen, just before we jump into this week's podcast, I wanted to drop in and just let you know that this week is going to be a two-parter. The reason is that when we sat down with our guest, as is often the way with Geelosophy, we didn't really have any plan as to what we were going to do, other than we knew that our guest had an incredible story and we wanted to listen to it. The result was that we ended up sitting down for just over 2 hours. And once the recording was done, Eke and I both agreed that it was hands down the most incredible podcast that we had recorded. We felt it was important to upload the podcast in its entirety, but we also recognize that 2 hours is a kind of a long listen for you guys. So we've broken it up into two parts to give you guys the chance to digest it. We're going to be uploading the first part today. The second part will be coming later on in the week. We can't wait for you guys to listen to it. And we really hope you enjoy.
What is that?
Jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is no joke. It takes years to master.
Martial arts are a vehicle for developing your human potential. And nothing in my life has ever put me in face with reality better than jiu-jitsu.
Training in BJJ offers a powerful lens through which to examine some primary human concerns. Truth versus delusion, self-knowledge, ethics, and overcoming fear.
There's more philosophy in our mats than actually philosophy in any Ivy League school.
Welcome to Geelosophy.
What up, everybody?
And welcome to another episode of
Geelosophy.
How you doing, bro?
Chilling like a villain.
Good stuff. Very special episode today. A guest we've been wanting to get on for a very long time.
Yes.
Sir, please introduce yourself.
My name is Rippon Dannis. And yeah, that's my name. That's it. that's the only introduction I need to do, I think.
I'll start with a story, right? So there is grading 2018.
Yeah. 2018, yeah.
Everybody gets a belt promotion. Rippon gets his blue belt. I'm really happy.
Yeah,
for
which
him.
by the way was so deserved, because yep. Just prior to that you won the LFF Cup as a white belt, right?
Yeah. No, I got to the final.
Got to the final.
Yeah, I got to the final. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing performance. You get up. You get your blue belt.
And then, I mean, you know, we all go out, there are beers, there's like food and blah, blah. A few days go by, we don't see Rippon in the morning class, we don't see Rippon in the evening class, the lunch, where the hell is it?
Yeah, it's like 2 weeks, right? Two weeks or something like that?
I think it was about, after the LFF yeah. Cup, I was training for at least a week,
mm-hmm.
and then after that, I disappeared,
yeah. Something happened.
So... Yeah. Ollie comes in one morning, like, guys, you don't, I can't do a British accent, but you don't know what happened. It's like, what happened?
I think at this point, we should let Rippon tell his story.
Okay, so, I mean, do you want to know about how I got into BJJ and then lead up to this?
We'll go back. This is like a good family type of story.
Basically, so I was training for about maybe 10 months
mm-hmm.
and was training really hard. I was doing... probably every morning session of BJJ, 5 days a week, obviously as a white belt, doing Muay Thai classes at LFF as well, doing the advanced classes. So I was training probably about like 7 to 8 hours per week at LFF. My diet was a porridge in the morning, one bagel with peanut butter at lunchtime, and then in the evening I would probably have something either vegetarian or fish based.
Mm-hmm.
So diet wise it was amazing. Fitness is probably in the best shape of my life. Got my blue belt, couldn't believe it, because I just thought this is going to take years, but I got this blue belt and I was just, oh my god, I've got this blue belt. And left with this blue belt thinking, oh my goodness, I am going to train so hard now and I'm going to get that black belt. Like, this is just the beginning. And then a week later, the week later something happened. I woke up a week after that in hospital, just looking at everybody. My friends, my family, and thinking, oh yeah, my mum's here. I wonder why my mum's here. Maybe I'm here to visit my mum because she has type 2 diabetes and the shock has made me forget what's going on. Yeah, yeah, I'm here to visit my mum. Then I see another friend.
We should add as well, at this point, you're in the hospital.
I'm in the hospital,
but you're still having these thoughts.
Yeah, I'm having these thoughts of like, okay, what's going on here?
By the way, you're in a hospital bed.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I couldn't actually see the hospital bed because I'm just looking out.
Right.
Just thinking like, hold on, my friend, my friend's here. Oh yeah, he does eat quite a bit. Like maybe I'm here to visit him and he's not healthy and blah, blah, blah. And then thinking, hold on, why are all my friends and family in this hospital? So I look to my girlfriend, Fiona, and like, oh, what's going on? So, Ripon, you've had a cardiac arrest. You've been in an induced coma for about 5 days. And they had to use a defibrillator to bring you back to life. And they've put 2 stents in your heart. And I thought about it for a second and just thought, why are you lying? Like,
do you think that was, do you think you were in the right frame of mind at that point? Do you think you really weren't processing it? Or do you think it was more like just a haze for you?
It wasn't even so much the haze because, I mean, the day I had my cardiac arrest, I'd just come out of LFF doing Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I was so buzzing from getting my blue belt. So I was like, even more like, I'm going to train even harder and I'm going to look after myself and eat better. This is the first day of the rest of my life. And then, so I came out, so I have no memory of this. So what I'm talking now is from what other people have told me has gone on. So I've literally no memory of this. I'm just going to tell you other people have told me here.
How big of a memory gap do you have then?
So it happened on the 6th of November 2018. My last memory is the 4th of November 2018. So two days prior, the Sunday night, I went to sleep.
And that's all you remember?
Yeah, that's all I remember.
So you slept for 2 nights?
Yeah, so I had, so Sunday night I went to sleep. Monday I went to work and that was a...
But you don't remember?
I don't remember any of this.
But you still went to work, you still trained, you still did all of this.
Monday I had my, went to work, did everything fine. Tuesday was the day that I do like advanced Muay Thai classes and I went there and I said to my, work colleagues, I was like, yeah, I'm going to Muay Thai tonight. I'll see you guys tomorrow. I might have a few bruises on my face, just to let you know. Right? And went. But that the Monday and the Tuesday, I have no memory of.
And so from that, I'm going to make an assumption that you were fully functioning, right?
Yeah, fully functioning.
So you were normal per se.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the memory loss has occurred because of the cardiac arrest.
Because of the cardiac arrest, yeah.
Got you.
So then what happened was, so I went to Muay Thai on the Tuesday, left, and then came out of a Highbury and Islington station. Now, when I come out of Highbury and Islington station, so where we used to live, I always turn left to go home.
Mm-hmm.
I have, like, when I finish, like, training and stuff, like, I don't do anything outside of that. It's like, I've gone training, I'm going to go home, and then have my meal, and that's, now I can chill.
Yeah.
I never used to kind of, like, falter and think, oh, I'm going to go do a bit of shopping here. I was like, no, I've done my training, going home, and that's the end of it. So I always turn left. Something must have happened for me to think, okay, I don't feel well, and I turn right. So I must have been panicking or something or other. Turn right, because when you turn right, it's more in towards Highbury and Islington, the main street, upper street. So you can walk down then, there's lots of shops and things. So I must have thought, oh my God, I don't feel good. I need to walk towards where there's lots of people and get someone to help me. I think I rang my girlfriend and she didn't pick up. And actually quite recently, she showed me the text message I sent her as well, which was, please call me back, emergency. And she still got the text message.
Wow, okay.
And then I must have collapsed. So I collapsed outside of a McDonald's in the on Upper Street. And it's right in front of a roundabout.
Mm.
And the roundabout at the time was having quite a lot of construction done. So it was quite... I collapsed in the middle of the road, so a car could have hit me as well during that time. So I had a heart attack, might have like fallen into the middle of the road, then went into cardiac arrest. So my heart stopped.
Right, so I was just I was just about to ask this, because some people may not know what a cardiac arrest is, right? What precisely is the difference between a heart attack and a cardiac arrest?
So a heart attack is, you could have a heart attack and still function. You could probably drive yourself to the hospital even, you know. It's just kind of the kind of blood flow and the electrical something, like it changes. And you just need a bit of a, like a, you just need some medical attention and they'll sort it out for you. But it's not, you know, you can still function with a heart attack. Cardiac arrest is your heart is stopped.
Right.
Your heart has stopped. You've now, essentially, you're clinically dead.
I was going to say, so yeah, by definition, your heart has stopped, you are now dead.
Yeah, yeah. Your whole body, everything is like closing down, or your brain's shut down, your you know, your internal organs, everything's just starting to like shut down. You are clinically dead. So I've collapsed in the middle of the road, and this is, you know, you can call this luck, you can call it divine event. Intervention, whatever, but two guys walked past, and I've been trying to get in contact and try and find out who these guys are, but I still haven't had any response, and I don't know who they are. But one person was a off-duty GP,
Whoa.
And one person was a police officer.
Wow.
Walked past, saw to me. One person started doing CPR, worked out that my heart had stopped. Another person ran to get a defibrillator from Highburn Islington Station. So the distance, you know, you're talking, it's a good, maybe like a 4 minute walk. So say 4 minute walk to the station, then to go and ask, where's the defibrillator? Grab the defibrillator, walk back to me, and then start, you know, using the defibrillator. So this is all going on. Whilst this guy's grabbing the defibrillator, my phone's rang, someone has picked up my phone, and like gone, oh, do you know who this phone belongs to? And my girlfriend's on the other line going like, yeah, it's my boyfriend's phone. Like, what's going on? He's like, yeah, he's collapsed outside of, you know, McDonald's in Upper Street. Do you think you can get him? He's like, yeah, yeah, I'm coming now. She thought, oh, he's probably trained so hard that he didn't drink enough water. I'm probably just fainted.
She passed out, right?
Passed out. And so she's run out of her house, run out of our flat, bumped into two off-duty paramedics in an ambulance.
Wow.
Right? And gone like, oh, my boyfriend's collapsed outside. And they were getting a curry. My boyfriend's collapsed outside of Highburn Islington Station. Like, can you go to them? I was like, yeah, yeah, we'll go there now. So they go there. She's run, got to me. And she's arrived at the point where the one of these guys is using the defibrillator to actually bring me back to life. So that's the point that she's arrived. They're using the defibrillator to bring me back to life. I think they used it like once or twice and then basically brought me back. I've now grabbed one guy and either started punching him or got him in a headlock.
Right.
And then the paramedics arrived and sedated me. And then put on the notes, because like Fiona had to ride in the back of the ambulance, and on the notes it said like, yeah, handle with care. It's like, you know,
aggressive,
highly confrontational.
Yeah.
Mm.
But again, I have
no idea,
zero memory of this.
Listen, I just want to jump in here, because one of the things that stood out to me most when I did first aid training is the statistics for CPR succession between having a defibrillator and not having a defibrillator. Now, I don't want to get these stats too wrong. I'm going to have a stab at it.
Yeah.
But I think it's something like 14, it's either 7 or 14% without a defibrillator, and then it's 50% if you do have a defibrillator.
Yeah.
It's some really extreme stat like that.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm pointing out the obvious here, but how fortunate that someone had the sense of mind to run and go and get a defibrillator and bring it back.
It's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. Like, you know, and I'm going to try not to cry now, but it was really difficult to understand, like to try and like gauge what had actually just taken place. Like in the beginning, I was like, oh, why has this happened to me? I've done everything right. I've trained hard. I've eaten right. I look after my body. I don't smoke. I don't drink. You know, I'm doing yoga. I'm breathing. Everything's doing right. So why has this happened to me? But then you look at the statistics and you just think like, yeah, it's because I did all of that, that I am alive. Obviously the defibrillator part is a massive factor, massive factor. But my actual recovery is down to the fitness. Like I used to go into St. Bart's to do checkups and stuff, you know, because after 2 months I was just pretty much back to normal. And they just couldn't believe the results. They were like, yeah, we can only put this down to how fit and healthy you were beforehand, because your recovery has been so swift that we're having difficulty actually believing what we're seeing.
Yeah. I really want to let you finish. I just on that point, did the doctors ever like get a reason why this happened?
No,
they
still, no one has any.
There's no kind of idea. There's no history of this in your family.
No history of this in my family. Obviously with my diet, I mean, I remember coming out of hospital and, you know, the doctors are going through like, oh yeah, this is like something to help you with your diet. So tell me about your diet. What do you eat? And I told them and they're like, yeah, you don't need this.
Wow.
Like you don't need this. Yeah. If anything, they were kind of, cause to get into like BJJ, right? So imagine, I've woken up in hospital. People are telling me these like stories about like, this is what's happened to you, da 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 da. And they're going like, yeah, they've put two stents in your heart. I look down at my chest and I have zero scars in my chest, on my chest, right? Thinking, what are they going on about, right? And they go, yeah, they've put like a, they put a tube through your wrist. Like that's lit. I mean, I can't even show, like that's it. That's the only scar I have.
Well,
that's it. It's barely visible, you know? So they put like a tube through your wrist that went into your atrium, and then they put like a balloon, like a deflated balloon through that tube with two metal meshes around it, and then they blew up the balloon, which then locked and kept your left atrium open, and then they took the balloon out and now the blood is like pumping through that.
And
now,
why have they done that? So you've had this heart attack. What's the actual damage that's been done?
The actual, what happened was, it was a complete blockage of my left atrium.
Right.
So caused by a blood clot. They don't know how that happened or anything, but they know that the blockage, that's what caused it. And then once the block happened, the what's called left atrium kind of closed on itself. So they had to put like the stent in to keep the
oxygenated blood flowing, right?
To get the blood flowing through there, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So you've gone in the hospital, you've gone in the ambulance,
yeah.
You've woken up in the hospital, you don't believe anyone that's telling
I thought this is the greatest practical joke ever, because they've spent a lot of money on this.
I'm being
punked.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's happening here.
Especially because like the last memory you have is, oh, I just went to sleep.
Yeah, I went to sleep and now I've woken up in hospital, but I was in an induced coma for 5 days. So so I have no memory of 7 days. So the 5 days I was in an induced coma and the 2 days that led up to my cardiac arrest, I have no memory. So 7 days are just gone.
And why did they put you in an induced coma?
Because I think they just had to get my vitals like really down. Because once they put the stent in and everything, it was like, okay, you know, we need to keep him like sedated, and then slowly take him out of the induced coma. And even for that now, like, because you know when it happens to you, it's all a bit jokey. Like I'm like, oh yeah, why is everyone so why is everyone in such like so sad. Like I don't understand. I feel all right.
Yeah.
But you know, some of the stuff that my family, my girlfriend, my friends had to go through, like, you know, they had to, especially for my girlfriend Fiona, like she witnessed me having a defibrillator used on me. So at that point it was like, this guy's dead. You know, this guy's dead. That's why we're using the defibrillator to maybe get him back. Then I've gone into hospital, they've made her sign documents, like, yeah, we have to put stents in. If we don't, he will die. So it's not even an option.
She's just sitting at her apartment. Now she has to make all these decisions all of a sudden.
You know, now she's in hospital having to make these decisions, like, you know, do you know, sign this waiver form off. You have to get these stents in. If anything goes wrong, like, you know, we're not accountable, but, you know, you need to sign this. We need to do this.
Was she your next of kin?
She wasn't. She had to phone up my family and say, like, oh, you know, this is what they're saying. Like, my brother-in-law is actually a doctor. So he said, like, yeah, you need to do this. Like, yeah, give him permission, sign everything. Like, it's really bad. My brother-in-law was saying to my sister, like, yeah, everything's fine. But he told me afterwards, he's like, yeah, actually, I didn't think you were going to make it because just as a doctor, what took place.
He knows too much.
Yeah. You really shouldn't have made it. Like, I use you as examples. Like, he does, like talks and whatnot in the medical field. And, like, he uses me all the time. He's like, yeah, this is a one-off. Like, this is rarely happens. Like, the kind of course of events that leads up to someone making it without any, like, real damage. I mean, like, one of the things, like, when I fell, I landed on my face, so I had, like, a massive black eye. And because I was on these blood thinners and whatnot, it made the bruise even more prominent. So I remember, like, my brother coming down to visit and my sister coming down.
The one who's the doctor?
Sorry?
The one who's the doctor?
No, my other, like, brother. Yeah, my brother and my sisters, like, my mum and my dad, they came to visit. And when they came to visit, because my brother was just like, yeah, you know, this kind of stuff happens to Rippon all the time. Because I've, in my life, so much stuff happens to me. They were like, yeah, this is just another story. He loves storytelling. This is just another story for him to tell. He'll be completely fine. And he's about to walk into my room. And Fiona goes to him like, Rahan, like, honestly, you need to be ready. Like, it doesn't look good. He's like, no, he'll be fine. He walked in and he walked out and he like went around the corner and just burst into tears. My best friend, like Ben, he came to visit as well. He's like, yeah, it's just another story. He's just a storyteller. Don't worry about it. He'll be completely fine. We've seen him go, you know, live through all sorts of stuff. Walks in, walks out, bursts into tears. Like, you know, these are grown men that like I have no problem showing my emotions and stuff, but it's not one of those things like they cry all the time. This must have been pretty bad. Mm. No one took pictures of me whilst I was, you know, in a coma, just because this is what they said to Fiona was, yeah, if he wakes up, so it's if, and they take you into a room, so there's like the bad news room, in the hospital, like, which is, yeah, this is where we take people when people are probably going to die. So took her into the bad news room and was like, yeah, if he wakes up, he might not be the same person again. We don't know how long the oxygen was out of his brain for. He could be paralyzed. He could be a vegetable. Like, we don't actually know what's going to happen when he comes out of the coma. Anyway, so they took the... they slowly started taking me out of the induced coma. And I think because I had all these tubes and things in my mouth, like... So when I woke up, my eyes are a bit, like, kind of in the middle. So I was like, what's going on? And so Fiona thought, oh, my God, he's a vegetable.
Oh my God.
Right. And then I couldn't speak because I had all these tubes down my throat. So I was like, and she was like, oh my God, like, I have to look after this guy.
I'm only laughing because you're okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny now. Like,
but at the time, that's terrifying.
Yeah. So that was that. And yeah, and then slowly, you know, I think Fiona gave me a piece of paper where I tried to write, like, what's happened to me with, like, a pen. It's all, like, messed up. And she was trying to explain to me. Like, again, I don't have any memory of this. When I first came out, because I was so heavily sedated with all the drugs and stuff, so I have no memory of any of this. And I remember her sister told me she started crying because I grabbed her and just tried to bring her towards me to just try and kiss her. And then they like went like, yeah, this guy's all right. But she burst into tears and everything. And then I was like writing like, I love you.
When does your memory start up again?
I think my memory probably started, I'd say, probably about a day and a half after coming out of the induced coma. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when did you realise the severity of it?
You know what? I was looking at... So I'll tell you. So when I woke up first, so once I accepted, okay, so I've had a cardiac arrest, da 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 da. I don't know why this has happened. It's like, fine. But this is no joke. And this is not because I'm on a BJJ like podcast. Yeah. My first question was, okay, because I landed on my face and I also landed on my finger and I'd broken my finger, my ring finger. Right, so wedding ring finger, so on my left hand. So I landed on that and broke it. And my only question was, when is my face going to get better? And when can you fix this finger? And they were like, but you've had two stents in your heart. Is that the only question you've got? Like, I just want to know, when is my finger going to get better? And when is my face going to get better? It's like, why is that so important? Because I need to get back to BJJ. I need to get back to LFF. I've just got my blue belt. This is just a little bump in my journey to get all my belts and get my knowledge. When can I go back? And they were like, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. Is that a contact sport? And I was like, yeah, like, but I can take it. And like, no, you don't understand. Like, you have to be now on this drug called a Trikagrelor. Which is like a industrial strength blood thinner. So the problem with that is it thins your blood to the point that if you get bruised, you bruise really easily. Hence why my eye had swollen up so much because they had to pump me full of this. So my eye was like out. Like honestly, it was like 3 inches from my face. It was.
And the reason is that a blood thinner by nature thins blood, but a bruise works by congealing blood, thickening blood. So obviously, if you can't thicken and you can't like solve,
yeah,
the bruise,
you could end. You know, if you get hit, you can have internal bleeding, internal bruising, all sorts of
and
stuff.
And even a small cut can be very
problematic. Any small cut. I remember when I came out of hospital, I was like, you know, say if you walk past like a table or a chair and you bump into it, and you know, oh, ow, and then you walk off, but then. At night time, you know, looking at my legs, like, oh, why have I got these big, massive bruises on my leg? Like, oh, yeah, I bumped into a chair. So wow. BJJ and Muay Thai at the time, that just wasn't going to happen for that 1 year.
No.
So this doctor tells you that?
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I'm going to prove them wrong. When can I start running again then? So I thought, oh, I've been in hospital for a while. Like, I need to get fit again. I probably haven't used my legs in about a week.
How much time did you spend in the hospital?
In the hospital, in total, I think I was in there probably 10 days. Hmm. Yeah, 10 days. Operation, everything. It's like a non-invasive operation, really. I don't even think you call it operation. There's like another term for it. But was out in about 10 days. And I remember just thinking, like, I remember... getting in the taxi and going home, and that's the first time it hit me, because I'd been in hospital for like 10 days and I was just looking out and I just burst into tears. I just could not believe that this had happened to me. And you know, the advice from the doctors at the time was, you know, take it easy, maybe take a 3 minute walk to begin with, and then just build it up by a minute each day. I was just thinking, listen, this might be something that you talk to, give advice to if someone's overweight or has a heart condition or hasn't been looking after themselves. Listen, I look after myself. I've been training this much. Like, they don't know what they're talking about. I'll be the exception to the norm. I get home and I walk up one flight of steps to go to the toilet. I am exhausted. Wow. Like... Yeah. I am full on exhausted, like I've run 20k or something, just by walking up maybe 5 steps. And I walked down the steps and tried to kind of brush it off. So Fiona and her mum and dad were downstairs because they brought me back from the hospital. And I just kept it to myself. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to let them know that this is the case. Otherwise, they won't let me go back out and train. And so that was my thinking. And the next day, I went like, oh, yeah, let's go for a walk. And she's like, oh, yeah, let's walk 3 minutes out. In my head, thinking, no, let's just walk as far as I can, like, walk, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's not listen to what the doctor's saying. I walked maybe 3 minutes. I had to sit down at this park bench. Got back up 3 minutes back. And I passed out. For 8 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. I got back home and I passed out for 8 hours. Woke back up and I was like, what day is it? It's like, yeah, it's pretty much the next day, you know? I'm like, okay. All right, yeah, maybe this is a bit, all the drugs coming out of my system and I just needed a rest, whatever. My body's just dealing with it. Today I'm going to walk even like further. Walk 4 minutes, come back home. After 4 minutes, again, rest at the bench, get back up, get back home. I've now passed out for about 8 or 9 hours, like even more so than the day before. And then I thought, then it hit me. Then it actually hit me. And then I was like, okay, this is going to be a long ride. At that point, like, you know, because I'd broken my finger and everything was stationary, right? So I couldn't do the things that I love. So I couldn't do my BJJ, couldn't do my Muay Thai, couldn't go running, couldn't even walk. I couldn't even play my guitar. So I thought, okay, I'll practice my guitar. I had a broken finger. So I was like, okay, nothing's getting played here. And I love reading. So I couldn't even read because my eye was so like sore. I couldn't even like properly focus on stuff. So I was literally just like sat on the sofa just watching TV and hating it. Yeah.
I was going to ask, do you remember how you felt in that time?
Again, like, I'm not saying this just because this is a BJJ podcast, but in my head I thought, okay, this is what's happening. This is horrible. I've just got to bide my time and I'm going to get back in the gym and I will show people that this is just a minor setback in the grand scheme of my life, and I will show people. But even that had some drawbacks as well. So because it was around Christmas time, we couldn't get booked in for cardiac rehab.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't start cardiac rehab until January. So when I went for like a meeting with the cardiac rehabilitation specialist, like, she said to me, like, look, we don't know whether the stents worked or not. It could get to the point where if they don't work, you might have to have like I forget what it's called now, it's like a built-in defibrillator,
mm-hmm.
right, put into your heart. If that is the case, then basically whenever your heart reaches a certain, like, if it beats too high, then it will shock you, right, and then kickstart again, which means you can't do any physical activity from that point, like, onwards. So I was facing the prospect of never being able to not just do BJJ, but just do no training, no nothing ever again. So all of Christmas was just like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do if this is the case? Could I even swim again? You know, could I? Yeah, because they were going like, yeah, you know, your heart might put too much stress on you going from cold temperatures up to like a higher temperature and trying to keep mm-hmm. your body cool, warm. Everything's just going to affect it. So all of Christmas was just that. Thank God, once January came, I went for my next meeting at St. Bart's Hospital and they were like, yeah, vitals are good. The stents are working fine. Like, yeah, you know, you can start doing your cardiac rehab. Started going to cardiac rehab. Again, I'm in cardiac rehab. So at the time I was 37 I was at the time. And I'm in there and the guy's in cardiac rehab with me, like 70 plus.
Wow.
Or massively overweight, you know. who have not looked after themselves or just gotten old.
Right.
You know, so those are the guys in there that, you know, are recovering from heart attacks, cardiac arrest. So those are the people I'm in there with. And I'm in there and I'm 37 years old.
You just shouldn't be there, right? Think,
what am I doing here?
Yeah.
All the guys coming up like, what actually happened to you? Did you get hit by a car or something like that? I was like, no, I actually just walked out of the gym and had a cardiac arrest and that's why I'm here. He's like, oh, were you not eating well? I was like, no, actually, this was my diet. Da, 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 da. They couldn't believe it.
Do you know the odds of that?
Yeah, the odds are... I used to have this, I had the odds memorized actually. So it was something like, what was it? Out of 10% of, what was it? People that have cardiac arrest, only 12% or something, or it depends on like Europe or UK, but it's something around like 12% survive. But out of the 12%, only 2% survive without any major, like problems. As in, like, you could have, like, speech problems. Like, you know, so far, the only issue I've got is that I have no memory of those.
And that's it.
Seven or 8 days, yeah.
Bro, you take that any day of the given week.
Right? Yeah. Like, I don't care. I don't want to remember it.
No.
You know, yeah, that's insane.
That is, honestly, one of the most incredible stories I've ever
heard. Yeah. It's pretty, yeah.
Last week, we spoke about setbacks, and I really don't feel like we did it justice. We spoke about injuries.
No, I heard it. And in my head, I was thinking, like...
you know nothing!
I know, no, it wasn't even that. I was like, oh, man, I know how you feel, like... I don't use what happened to me as a kind of like, oh, I lord it over you because I had it like worse.
No.
Like when someone talks about like, oh, I wish I could like train and I can't because of the setback. I'm like, yeah, man, I know how you feel. Like,
but what I would say though is you're a pretty good benchmark. Like if someone's there like, you know, I ate a bit too much, I drank a bit too much. You're there like, yeah, you know, when I had my cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
Shut up.
But they told, you know, one of the things that actually resonated with me the most then is they told you that you may never be able to do even the most basic.
Yeah, not even the basic ever. Stuff, yeah.
I guess when you get told the stents are working, you have a shot. That's just a literal new lease of life, right? Yeah. How long did it take from that point? Because you came back to jiu-jitsu. And I remember, I actually vividly remember you.
Yeah, I remember this actually.
I remember you walking through the door.
Yeah.
And I remember getting emotional.
Yeah.
Because you, by all accounts, I don't want to get too morbid, I don't want to play on this, but you shouldn't have come back.
No.
Right? So you walk through the door and I just remember thinking the journey you must have gone on from when it happens to walking back through those doors, I don't think anyone bar you is going to know what that was like. But what was it like when you came back?
Oh my God. So... when I was recovering, and again, like I was mentioned about the cardiac rehab. So the cardiac rehab, I've been there with like, you know, 70 plus year olds and people that are like overweight. And I'm this like young guy, 37, who was prior to that in the peak of fitness, actually. And they were telling them to like, yeah, now lift these dumbbells really slowly. And I was thinking, like, oh my God, give me a heavier dumbbell. But even the lightest dumbbell and, you know, what do you call those elasticated...
The elastic band.
Yeah, the elastic band things. Even they were like, oh my God, this is really hard. I'm literally going to have to rebuild everything, like everything from scratch, like, you know. And so it was 2 months of cardiac rehab. And then after the 2 months of cardiac rehab, they offer like a gym membership for people that have recovered. It's Better Gyms.
Right.
So Better Gyms are on London. So there's one around the corner. I thought, okay, well, I've got this like membership and it was basically nothing, cost hardly anything. Joined that back up and just was working on the treadmill, rowing machines. There was a punch bag there, just slowly starting to get my fitness back, but it was really hard, like really hard.
Was it demoralizing?
It was demoralizing in the sense that because I knew what I was, but I just kept on telling myself, like, okay, you're not that person now, but there's a potential that maybe you can get there. But even if you don't get there, just be happy with where you've got to. So it definitely, there was something inside of me that said, like, okay, I've done a little bit more than the last time I went there. Okay, there's actual progress. I can see and feel the progress. So that was keeping me going. And then, you know, the whole thing of like BJJ, like you know, you both know, like, if when it gets you, that's it. You're hooked. You know, it's just a love relationship. Right, there's no hate in it. There's just like a love relationship. You know, I wanted to come back so much. That was like the fire. Just getting to LFF, like, not just, you know, it's not just the BJ, it's just LFF as a whole. I just had to get back there. But my journey going up there, I couldn't even walk into the gym. I didn't even want to walk in there. I, you know, felt like, no, I'm not going to walk back in here until I'm on the verge of, like, yeah, I can come back here now. Like, I just had to prove to myself that I will walk back here when I am ready to actually physically walk back in here. So I was training, and then I got to a good point and I thought, okay, this is it. I'm gonna walk in now. And it was, I think it was like October, September, October. So almost a whole year after my cardiac arrest, and it was like, okay, soon I'm going to be off my like blood thinners and everything, and then I can start training. And I walk in, I saw Ollie, and he just like jumped, ran towards me. I was in like my work gear, so I was in my suit and tie and everything. Ollie was absolutely drenched in sweat.
No change,
like,
there.
Yeah. Like, hugged me. I was drenched in sweat, and I was like really quite taken back from it. Dana as well, who does a BJJ, she was doing, I think, Muay Thai at the time, ran across, gave me a massive hug, and it was just like, I'll get onto it, but like, it was just so overwhelming. I got so emotional. I didn't cry at that point. I was talking to Helen, who works at LFF. She's on the counter, and she was just talking through me. She gave me a hug and, you know, was explaining to me that after they'd heard what had happened to me, they'd actually ordered a defibrillator to be put in the gym. And she said to me, oh, I'll go try not to get emotional here. Whew. So she said to me that they went to get a defibrillator to put in the gym because they thought one of our people has collapsed. You know, if he'd have collapsed inside of the gym, then because we don't have a defibrillator in here, he might not have made it. So let's just put a defibrillator in here in case that anything like this happens again. And like that was like really emotional.
Oh, bro. It's family, right?
It was unbelievable. And then I stepped out of the gym and I waited at the bus stop and I burst into tears because I just couldn't believe that this like place I'd been like training like all through my recovery time I just got to get back to LFF. And you know, you have these like thoughts like, oh yeah, when I go back, no one will probably remember me, no one will know like me, yeah, you know, no one will remember anything, I'll just continue, no one will know anything about me. But the fact that everyone knew, everyone made an effort to just like make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen, and if it does, we're ready. It was like one of the, like, I could have died, but if I die again, that is something that I will take to the grave with me. That is like a memory that is one of the best memories of my lifetime so far. Honestly.
Oh, bro.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
Sorry, wow. Sorry, guys.
Thank you so much.
Please
sharing.
Don't apologize. Yeah. Bro, I want you to know that we never stopped talking about you, bro. The second we knew that you were okay, we were just waiting for you to come back, and we knew you would. And when you did, man, it was just incredible.
Yeah, honestly, it was like, at the time, I didn't actually. So Lorenzo used to teach Lawrence used to teach the beginners white belt classes, which actually we all started at that beginners class. And Danny Galinho, I used to see him training, but he wasn't in that class. And I didn't really know him even. I used to see pictures of him on the wall and thought, oh, this guy must be quite good. And I used to see him like training no gi and used to really go at it. And I thought, man, that guy like is training hard and all the rest of it. And I remember waking up in the hospital and finding this quite a few cards. I got a card from like Aaron the Muay Thai coach, and a joint card from like the BJJ guys. But there was a card from Lawrence and Danny Galinho, and it was like, oh mate, we came to visit you.
Yeah.
Hope you're all right. And I remember, I think, when I started back after my, I was crying at the bus stop. Then 2 months later, so in November actually, so it'd been a year since my cardiac arrest, and my 1 year old daughter was born. So that's another thing.
What?
Yeah. So all the while, whilst I was recovering, I had a baby. So
wow.
So she was born pretty much a week after I had my cardiac.
Oh my goodness.
A year to the anniversary of my cardiac arrest. So she, for me, is this like just special being where I look at her and think, if I hadn't made it, you wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I've made it. Now I can see you. It's the most mad thing. So I was busy kind of raising her for about, November to December. And I thought, January is here. January 2020. Right. January 2020. This is the year that everything changes. That is an understatement, right? So I am going to train so hard. I'm off these blood thinners. Like, I've got the support of my LFF family. I've got the support from my own family, like Fiona, like my brothers and sisters. My mum was just like, oh yeah, maybe you shouldn't fight anymore because of the stuff. I was like, mum, you know I can't do that. And she's like, yeah, if you don't do it, then he just wouldn't be you, would you? So you may as well just carry on going. And I got all this support, was going there, was training pretty much, 5 to 6 days a week. BJJ, Muay Thai. I remember actually, when I got my blue belt first time round, I remember putting it on and thinking, oh, it seems a bit small, right? And thinking like, oh yeah, maybe, blue belts. Because I didn't know anything about it. So Luis put the blue belt on for me. I thought, oh, it looks a bit smaller than my... around my waist. Like, oh, maybe it's because blue belts are... It makes it difficult for people to grab your belt. That's why I've done it, right?
And the first sneaky blue belt trick. Yeah.
So I start back up in January. Luis sees me and he's like, oh my God, you're here. I can't believe it. He's like giving me a hug and he's like talking to me. And I go like, I want to start back up. What do you think I should do? He's like, look, start off at the beginner class just to get used to it. And then you can move on to the advanced class. I was like, yeah, no problem. He was like, hey, you've put on a bit of weight. The belt doesn't fit you properly. I was like, I haven't. I'm not fat. This is the belt that you gave me. It's too small. So I was like, oh, now I've got to train even harder. So then I went out, was training harder. But that's just the banter level. I just loved it. Loved coming back, yeah.
I think I already know the answer to this question, but when you came back, you've gone through this ordeal, but from a jiu-jitsu point of view, you were a blue belt.
Yeah.
Going back to the beginners, did it bother you at all?
Didn't bother me one bit.
No.
Like, the belts, I think you asked John a question like once, like, are you, if you thought you're going to be a white belt for the rest of your life, would you keep on training? I would 150% keep on training. Like, it's not, I didn't get into BJJ for the belts. I honestly didn't. Like, I just the way I am, I like being fit, but I like learning a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of my background, like, I grew up in a part of the world where, you know, I was the ethnic minority of the whole area. Like, mm-hmm. there was no other people. I represented that person. And I got a lot of racism, and I used to get into lots of fights, and, you know, and I used to train, and, like, I used to get into fights, not from me looking for fights, but just people were just having fights with me and scraps with me. Right. And I used to have to, you know, beat people up to protect myself. And, you know, my temper was, like, quite hard to control, because I knew these people, I just wanted to be left alone, but all these people kept on coming at me, and I just couldn't control my temper anymore. I was like, I want to be left alone, you won't let me, so I may as well just beat you up. And they just kept on coming, and it didn't stop. So when I got into kind of martial arts and, like, fight sports and all the rest of it and stuff, it just kind of channeled that anger and just taught me about, kind of, you know, it is like a Bruce Lee term, like, fighting without fighting. You are fighting, but you're not actually fighting. It's not a street fight situation.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to gouge your eye out. No one's going to hit you with a bottle. No one's going to grab a knife. Like, you know, if you can't take it, you can tap out. There's, like, a safety within the gym. There's rules. And I just love the fact, and I, you know, you guys have trained with me. I never got angry.
No.
Never once. Like, you know, the only one time I ever got angry in the gym was I was doing a boxing with Silvio.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to sparring, and this guy, so usually, you know, you touch gloves before you spar.
And he went through for it.
No, and, like, I put my hands up, and he just punched me.
Oh, my God.
Straight right hook.
Protect yourself at all times.
Right. And I just thought, like, what did you, like... And this guy was smaller than me. And I just thought, no, I'm just going to beat you up now. And we went for it, and the rounds went, and it got to the end. Silvio comes up, and he's like, what do you think you're doing? Like, you know, you're much bigger than him, da-da-da-da-da. And, like, I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, Silvio. Because, again, Silvio's never seen me get angry.
Yeah.
So it's quite, you know...
Out of character.
Out of character for me, and, like, he's never seen it. And then the minute he stopped talking to me, he went like, and you, what the hell do you think you're doing hitting someone? He's trying to touch gloves. This is sparring. And he's like, really went at it. I never saw that guy again.
Oh, really?
Actually, yeah. He got a proper, like, talking to. I never seen him. I haven't seen him in the gym since, yeah.
Man, that's a shame. It sounds like he needed to stick around and
But that was the one time. But again, it was, for me, the whole training is because I just feel so safe in there. So when the guy hit me, I just thought, you've just put me in the non-safe zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, this isn't what I signed up to.
Yeah.
And so now let's make it unsafe. So, yeah, so.
I mean, that's the thing, is that you put an enormous amount of trust.
Yeah,
Not just in your training partner, actually, but in the higher belts, right?
Yeah.
To stop when you tap.
Yeah.
Or even if you have a submission, to not insist. Like, if the guy maybe isn't tapping, like, let it go, man. You don't need to break your training partner's arm. That's the whole point of jiu-jitsu.
It's like, get to the edge and just not throw someone.
Yeah,
exactly. So you're back.
So then I'm back in the gym training, and I'm absolutely loving it, and I feel like, yeah, this is what it's all been about. My, you know, because that was the light, you know. In my dark tunnel of, you know, going through, you know, the recovery and all the rest of it, like, LFF at the end of it was the destination. Mm. Like, that, you know, this whole route, that's the journey, but the destination is that, like, I'm now at my destination, and now it's the beginning of my next journey.
Incredible.
And, like, it's my next journey. And then bloody COVID hit. Right?
So COVID hit. So you trained January
February, March, yeah.
And then?
Nothing, right? And COVID hits, and I, you know, there's so many things happening. You know, got, like, furloughed. So with my job, it's kind of sales-based, so I have to, it's a lot of, like, client-to-client kind of talk. If that's not happening, there's no commission.
Mm.
So I'm kind of living almost on the breadline, like, okay, I've got to pay rent. I'm not getting any commission. I am furloughed, but I'm not getting any of my commission. So this is not the wage that I used to get. So I think I was able to do the video kind of Zoom like training sessions at LFF. Did that for about a month or so. And then, like, you know, funds were depleting. I was like, okay, you know, I have to kind of, you know, give it a miss for the time being. Like, you know, I had to freeze everything. I'm okay. I'll just wait for when lockdown, you know, is over and then get back into it. But when lockdown happened for me, because of the stents in my heart, I was put under the vulnerable category.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it was horrible. Like, I had to get, because Fiona and I live together, so, you know, the government sends you like a thing, like, oh yeah, fill in this form. Does anyone live with you yet? Yeah. Are they able to get food? And like, yeah, they can. Okay, so we're not going to deliver the stuff to your house. And I don't mind that, because, you know, obviously people that really need it and haven't got anyone to help them, like, deliver the, like, food to them, like, I think they're the main priority. I have another partner, but because everyone was so scared, my friends, family, like my partner, they were thinking, like, yeah, you know, you've got this heart issue. And at that stage, we didn't know the full ramifications of what COVID was able to do and what it can do and, like, who it's going to affect the most. So I was pretty much housebound. I was pretty much housebound for, yeah, most of, you know, COVID.
Right.
Fiona was having to go out, do the shopping, so she'd have to carry like a bag full of stuff, come back with our like a food shop and everything. And then I couldn't see my 6-year-old daughter's, you know, from a previous relationship, but I couldn't go to see her because she lives in Alexandra Palace. I live in Walthamstow, so it's, you know, over 10K. I think about 10K, yeah, I know it's 10K, yeah, to get to her. I didn't have any car. Everyone was advising me don't get on public transport or anything like that. So I was kind of stuck. So I didn't see her for about 2 months. And then I just couldn't take it anymore. I hadn't seen my six-year-old daughter in 2 months. And I just thought, okay. And it was Ramadan at the time. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try fasting. So I fasted for 1 month, but during my fasting, 3 times a week, I would do 5K runs whilst on Ramadan.
Right.
Right. And slowly, I thought, like, okay, Alexandra Palace is 10 kilometers away. So if I can get back into decent shape to be able to run to Alexandra Palace to see my daughter and then get the fitness to also run back as well. And yeah, at the end of Ramadan, it was Eid, like, gave it 2 days. And then I bought this toy for her and I put it on my back and I ran to Alexandra Palace, did this 10K, which I hadn't done before, ran 10K, like, knocked on the door. We had to do a social distance thing. You know, she hadn't seen me in 2 months, which for a six, or at the time she's five, for a 5-year-old is a long, long time.
Yeah, man.
She's like, oh, daddy. And I was like, oh, hey, how's it going? And I had to gave her this present and she was just talking. And, you know, we used to do Zoom chats and Safra, my daughter, every now and again, we used to have a designated time to talk to each other. But every now and again, she'd go moments where she wouldn't talk to me.
Mm.
So I asked her, like, oh, Safra, you know, sometimes you wouldn't talk to me, like, was there anything wrong? She's like, I didn't talk to you because I was sad, Dad. And I was like, oh yeah, like, what was making you sad? And it's like, because sometimes I'd see your face and I just want to jump through the screen and just hug you. And I was like, okay. And I had to hold it in because, like, but when I ran home and I got home, I talked to my mum. I was burst into tears again. Like, I hadn't seen her in you know, both my daughters, like, I feel like they're the, like, stents in my heart, you know, they're the things keeping my heart going, like, you know, that's what they're what I live for, you know. BJJ is kind of, like, what makes life, like, that extra bit, like, but they're the main things. My two daughters are just, I love them to bits, so whenever I hug them, like, you just can't help but have these moments where you just sat with them thinking, like, oh my god, like, this is so lovely.
Incredibly lucky, man.
Yeah.
Incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Really beautiful.
Oh god, this is really emotional.
Oh, I'll tell you. No, listen, yeah. Like, Iki, I'll tell you about emotional, right? This is no joke. So I was listening to the podcast the other day.
Yeah.
I think it's episode 14 or 15. And Iki, you're talking about how you got your blue belt.
Yeah.
And I love it because it starts off like, there was a promotion. So I was like, oh, someone got their blue belt. Iki's telling the story. So it's like, obviously, Iki's got his blue belt. And I'm thinking, like, it's like an episode of Columbo. You know someone who's done the murder, but let's find out how he did it. It was like that. I was like, hooked. And like, on that day, actually, because you were mentioning Mike Tyson as well, I actually did the Mike Tyson training one of the days of his whole training day that day. And one of the things he drinks is a tropical juice, right? And I went into Tesco, I'm listening to the podcast, and Iki's talking about his getting the blue belt, and I've burst into tears at the tropical juice section in Tesco. And people are looking at me, I'm like, these onions in my basket, they're really strong, aren't they? Yeah, and they're like, oh, this crazy guy. Like, yeah. So,
That's quite interesting. You know, like, it's like, we talked about this. Like, for example, I struggle with, like, showing emotions like that, like, sort of letting them come out. Yeah. This has been, like, the number one lesson for me this year, because one day I woke up to school and stopped crying.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I can't run away from this. And you were like, oh, yeah, I was just at Tesco and just versus the tears. Versus the tears.
But I think as well, you know, you can go into masculinity and all the rest of it. There's so many different ideas of what it is, and you can become hyper-masculine. Like, you know, why do we go to the gym and get ripped? Because it's just like this hyper-masculine idea of what you think a man is supposed to look like, act like, talk like, and all the rest of it. I do feel like when you do things like BJJ or any kind of like fight type of sport, especially the morning classes, right? So you go there and you've just been strangled.
Yeah.
Right? You've been choked. You've been strangled. You might have even had an armbar put on you or anything like that, right? And then you go into work. And I used to be so happy. And everyone's like, why are you so happy? He's like, listen, I've just been choked. The day cannot get any worse than that. It can't get any worse. And as a result, there's almost like a kind of a stamp on your manhood. It's like, listen, I've just done BJJ this morning. Yeah. I've just done Muay Thai this morning. If I cry, you can't question my masculinity because there's nothing to like question here.
One of the things I think is quite incredible is if you don't have any kind of martial arts in your life, I don't care who you are, if you walk into a fight gym, a jiu-jitsu gym, they're going to beat you, but it's going to be in one of the most respectful ways that you can possibly imagine. It's not going to be taunting or trash talk or mocking you.
Yeah.
It's just going to be going through the movements because they have the technique and they're going to beat you. And I don't care if you think you're a man's man and you've got all the abs and the muscles in the world, they're going to beat you. And then what's going to happen is you're going to realize that this idea of who you were, of this man that you thought you were, is going to be thrown into question. And you're not going to be able to escape from it because it's going to be there.
Yeah.
This guy beat you. Now what? And I think that is one of the most beautiful things about jiu-jitsu, because the only thing you really can do is lose that ego, lose that sense of what you think you should be, and discover very naturally in a very safe and respectful environment exactly who you are. And I think that is incredible. Really incredible.
It's like, you know, I always talk to people like, mate, you need to do it, you need to do it, you need to do it. And, you know, people, obviously I'm really passionate about it. Mm. And they're just like, you know, some people are like, oh, you know, this guy's always been into fighting, you know, he's a bit crazy, maybe that's why he likes it, it won't be like the right thing for me. And, you know, I was like obsessed with it, like, you yeah. know, like obsessed with it. It was, I think I do suffer from a highly addictive personality, mm-hmm. right? So
we can relate.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, okay, if you're kind of, if your makeup is that way and you've got a highly addictive personality, it's kind of like, okay, well, if I do get addicted to stuff really easily, I may as well put really good stuff in there. Mm. So BJJ, Muay Thai, training, that's only a good thing. Mm. If you get addicted to, because I read a lot now, like, you know, that was all getting addicted to, all right, I want to try and read this many, like,
books
and one book leads to the other book, and I want an idea, an understanding yeah. of this. Or you see like a genre of movies, you think, no, I want to watch every genre, like every movie of this genre, so I can reference like, you know, or what they're using, this is actually a biblical story, okay, now I need to read the Bible to work out where the story is going, and all of that, man.
But isn't that the difference, right? Like, you talk about putting good things into your body.
Yeah.
So there's that to me distinguishes a slight difference. Maybe you used to have a highly addictive personality. Yeah. Maybe now you have a highly committed.
Yeah.
Because you realize that actually the stuff I want to put in is the stuff I want to dedicate my time to, right? And that's perhaps a difference. You are choosing now to benefit yourself.
I mean, it's tough with time management.
Yes.
Obviously, I've got two kids, right? And like, my one-year-old is a real handful. She really is. I love her to bits, Isabella. But like, how I'm going to, you know, the next, like, the biggest challenge for me now is how to continue training whilst with the family.
Yeah.
Because my intention is, it's set. It's like, that's set in stone. I want to get to the highest level of BJJ that I can possibly get. And that might take me up to the, you know, 90 years old or something. You know, if I live that long, I will keep on going at it. But I understand that there's going to be moments in your life that, okay, I will have to take a break here.
Mm.
I just think about it. But, like, for instance, like, I'm not able to train now. Again, you know, there's, you know, some fears for my family as well. They're just thinking, like, oh, you know, with COVID and stuff, with your heart, you know, you don't really want to be in, like, a gym situation because, you know, it's quite tough and everything. So I am kind of, okay, since I can't do that, I'm going to go running. So I run like, you know, 10K, 5K pretty much three times a week. I do a lot of jump rope training. Mm. Like, that's on my Instagram. And like, again, with my Instagram, it's called Cardiac Arrested Development. And that was to reach out to other people that had a cardiac arrest or heart attack who were fit as well. And like myself, don't know why it happened.
Have you had many people reach
loads,
out? Really?
Absolutely loads.
That's incredible. That's amazing.
Like, shout out to Scott Graham. He was Stuntman, Brian, these guys, right? So Scott Graham, he's this fitness instructor, and he is ripped like you would not believe. He had his cardiac arrest almost a year after I had my cardiac arrest. So he got in contact with me going like, oh yeah, I've looked at your Instagram and used to be a really fit person and now you're kind of getting back into it. I've just had mine and da 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 da. And you know, he's like, I think he's about, sorry Scott, I don't want to talk about your age, but he's a few years older than me. And he's unbelievably, like, athletic.
Mm.
I think he held a record for, like, CrossFit in the States for years, like 18 years. He teaches now in Denmark. And, you know, he got in contact with me and we're, like, just discussing people, like, oh, you know, you're on this medication. What's the medication like? Oh, you know, it does make you feel a bit like this, that and the other. And it's just great to have another person to kind of talk through. Because, you know, yeah. if someone just goes, oh, yeah, I had cardiac arrest, and it's like, well, you know, you're not looking after yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know what I can talk to you about.
Yeah. Like, these guys are relatable, right?
Yeah, yeah, these are like, yeah, we were fit.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know why this happened. So, you know, we've kind of come to the conclusion that it was probably down to maybe stress. You know, different stresses throughout your life has put too much pressure on our hearts, and at one point something had to give.
Hey guys, so if you've made it this far, then you've made it to the end of part one of Rippon's story, and I think it should be pretty clear to you guys why this was such an incredible experience for both Eki and I. Part two is coming up, and in it we speak a bit more about his cardiac story. We also touch on some other experiences of his life, and in the end we loop it, as always, back to jiu-jitsu. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did recording it, and we can't wait for you to hear it.